Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled, It's Been Recorded, and it's about a collision of two musical universes, one being mine and the other is, well, our guest for this episode knows something about a musical universe different from mine, Mr. John Charney. Hey.
Hello, man.
Hello. Explain to the good folks listening at home, the three of you, where are we right now?
We're in the middle of a graveyard in Loretto, Pennsylvania, the place where I used to sit and do my homework when I went to college at St. Francis University. In fact, probably the same exact location. I apologize for the slope of the hill because, you know, the mic looks like it might want to do a face plant. It's all sensitive and stuff, so I should watch what I say because it's really sensitive.
Yes.
So, yeah, we're here in Loretto, PA in a graveyard.
St. Michael's Cemetery in Loretto, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, the Minor Basilica St. Michael's of Loretto, Pennsylvania. They have a new roof there now. Mm. Those shingles are those orange things, and the old ones were replaced. They threw them in a dumpster, and I really wanted to use them for my fire pit, but I waited too long. So I was hoping you'd be there for the theft of the refuse, but it just didn't happen.
No, stealing from the graveyard. Yeah, so here we are. It's a beautiful spring day. Summer starts apparently tomorrow. And I guess we should explain, this collision of two musical universes. The two of us, and I think we're very good friends, very close friends. And yet, in terms of the Venn diagram, let's think about this. Let's start with this. The Venn diagram of musical, the overlap for us is, I think it has gotten bigger over the years, but is not a large swatch. And we have these two different musical frames of reference. And I think that is the purpose of our conversation today, is to explore those two musical frames of reference.
That's, I could think of nothing more enlightening on that aspect. Well, because, I mean, some of the greatest bands have, if you make the correlation between bands and what we're doing, is some of the best bands have the most divergent influences in their respective members. Like, one of my favorites, Faith No More, every member was completely different from the other when it came to their influences. I mean, you have the Venn diagrams, like you said, where things would coalesce, but some of the most interesting things were the things that did not intersect, and that's where you had the originality kind of pop out of it.
Yeah.
And you know, may have cost them some sanity along the way and some fights and whatnot. But you and I are very respectful of each other's respective influences, so I like that.
Yeah. So I will say, so in terms of the Venn diagram overlap, I have to tell the origin story of our friendship,
which is always wonderful.
And yes.
I never tire of. So shoot, 1998.
A mutual friend of ours. Should I say his name?
Oh, of course.
Oh, you narcissist. Oh,
shout out.
We shouldn't, because then narcissist, he'll listen. And he'll be like, why are you saying my name? So let's not say his name.
Okay. It's Jason Geschwind.
Oh! Hi, Jason. Hope you're enjoying Cuba or the Man Cave or wherever you are listening to this.
Probably the Man Cave. It'll take at least a year to get this thing rendered out there in real time.
Yes. So he invited you over. This has been when we were disastrously roommates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so he invited you over. And everybody's, oh, John, he's a cool guy. You know, you just got to get used to him or whatever. And with the disclaimer.
That's what I always say about him. He's a good guy. You just got to get used to him.
Yes. And so you came over and immediately, and this was back when my vinyl collection fit on one maybe 2 foot wide shelf.
Sounds like more like 40 years ago rather than 19.
Yeah.
Because I can't picture that happening anytime lesser than 20 years.
Yeah.
Because you have probably a wing and a half and such a dining room of records.
I probably around 4,000 now.
So this was back in 63.
This is back in 63. They were all 78s now.
Yeah.
And we were just talking, and you saw the records, and you were like, oh, hey, can I look through the records? I remember you pulled them all out of the shelf, you know. And this was back when even alphabetizing them was not hard. And one of the first records you pulled out was, of course, A-ha Scoundrel Days.
Was it the very top, even though it was not alphabetized?
It might have been. I might have done the letter by letter instead of the word by word. So, hyphen, you know.
Because in my iTunes, A-ha is the first band. Mm. Just because of that alphabetical wonder.
Yes, because of the hyphen.
It's real easy to put them at the top.
Yes.
I mean, so that's probably, you know, your initial alphabetizing
scheme.
Yeah, help me out here, you know. So, yeah top.
Yeah, so it's top. And you remarked that it was not the one with Take On Me on it. I did not have that. I have that seven-inch... picture sleeve.
I heard that
single.
About you.
But I did not have it. I told the story about how when I was a kid, back when MTV doing that thing that MTV used to do, where whatever was the popular thing at the time was the greatest thing. It's never been this great ever.
Right, right.
And they did, MTV Europe had just launched, and in the MTV News program they had the MTV Europe countdown, and they played this little clip of this A-ha song called I've Been Losing You. Mm-hmm. And I described it as like, this song haunted me. I heard like 10 seconds of it, and it just seemed like this, you know, epic statement against the world or something. And I was obsessed by it, and I asked for it for Christmas, and my mom found it. My mom somehow found the A-ha record that nobody in this country bought.
What year was that?
So that was the year, that was the album after Take On Me. So that might have been
87-ish.
87-ish or so.
Take On Me was probably 85, I'm thinking.
Yeah, so I was 10 years old.
Oh, I think we got an ATV rider. Oh. Now he's headed towards Crescent, or Sankertown. So, anyways.
Anyway, they'll be immortalized in podcasts. Uh-huh. And I said this, I described it as this 80s Swedish synth pop epic. Which is like the nerdiest fucking thing you could say. You know what I mean?
Just there's totally, nerdier things.
There's nerdy, but that's pretty nerdy.
You didn't mention Shadowfax.
Yeah, this is true. Pretty damn nerdy, though. And you just, with a complete lack of irony and with actually, the utmost curiosity, you were like, can we hear it? You know what I mean? And I just knew, I was like, okay, this guy's cool. Like, yeah. I could say something that obscure and just, ooh, can we hear it?
Well, the reason being probably is because I could sense you weren't being ironic. You know, when someone has that kind of passion about things that mean that much to them and can put a label on it like that without even flinching to a brand new friend to be.
Yeah.
it's pretty genuine and authentic. So I think that's why we bonded so early like that.
Yeah, at the time, I was the deepest I could ever possibly be into my post-punk pretension. And that sort of nihilism, minimalism. You're not supposed to have a good time with music, man. You're supposed to be obscure and angry.
Is this Morrissey-ish? Smiths?
Yes. I went through a period in my life, and this is maybe a couple years after that period, where I listened for six months to Morrissey and the Smiths, and especially heard the songs How Soon Is Now and That Joke Isn't Funny Anymore.
Right on.
Because somebody gave me a mixtape with those songs back to back, and I probably listened to both of those songs every day for at least 6 months.
Well, may I interject as far as just an aside of a mixtape deal? Not a mixtape, but what I had received from you that I had borrowed was Typo Negative October Rust and Fishbone's Chim Chim's
Badass Revenge.
So I just wanted to mention that because if it weren't for you, I mean, like one of those two, October Rust is a deserted island album for me.
Wow.
And if it weren't for you, if it wasn't for you, I would never have, you know, plumbed the depths of that particular obsession. So, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
So, back to the topic.
Back to the topic. Okay, so that's where the Venn diagram crosses.
Yes.
You know, and I think for me, you know, listening to New York college radio, Typo Negative was a hometown band. You know what I mean? So,
right on.
But you think at the time, I will say I was never in anything that theatrical and that grand and that big.
Yeah, yeah. They definitely have those sumptuous opus epics where the keyboards are not really, you know, assuming a prominent role, but they make them, I think, grander because of the fact that, you know, you have his voice being very unique and deep and Dracula-oriented in a way.
And three testicles.
Whoa.
Yeah, and Peter Steele and Howard Imus, actually. Don't ask me how I know this, but those Don Imus and Peter Steele, I guess Peter Steele in past tense, three testicles.
So we're
it's more common than you think, supposedly.
So this is the three-testicle bass baroque baritone he's getting it from. Then.
Yes.
He had range, too.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. I had no idea he had three testicles.
Yeah.
I mean, you learn something old every day. Mr. Rogers said that a lot. Anyway, yes. I had to quote him. But anyways, yeah, I mean, the vibe of their music really appealed to me because it was very ornate is a good word for it, too, because you could really envision what they were singing about without the lyrics. I mean, you could actually wine, wood smoke. He didn't even have to say wood smoke, and I could smell wood smoke.
Yeah.
You know, the middle of the woods at night and just, you know, the Anne Rice-isms and all those things. We're very suggestive and were the soundtrack to many riding the day away days for me before I picked up my little brother for his piano lesson. You know, it's like 70 minutes, that album, you know. And there's a place that's near Northern Cambria. It's actually Harmony School District area. There's a lot of great ride and roads. And I like to do that. I like to just put on music and go for a ride in the ruralness of this area. And that album was the album for 1998, 1999 on those rides. So
wow.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome.
So yes, the crossover again.
The crossover. So you got Faith No More, we got Fishbone, we got Typo Negative.
The Beatles.
You
had Beatles records too.
I did have Beatles records, yes.
The red greatest hits, the blue greatest hits, right?
Yes, I did, and that was before I had accumulated the others. Back when nobody was buying Beatles records, and I could buy those records for a dollar.
And this was way before the Ruddles.
Yes, way before, well, the Ruddles existed, but...
before our Ruddles.
Before our Ruddles, before which was, last week.
Before our joint purchase.
Yes.
You know, I Let It Rot, the Tragical History Tour, the Fool on the Pill.
I have not listened to that record. Have you had a chance to listen to that yet?
I actually played it for my brother and his friend a couple days ago, and they're major Beatles fans. Mm. And one of the songs is called Number One, and it's basically just saying that they're just shooting for a number one hit. You know, kind of. So they enjoyed it. It was excellent. I haven't checked out Side 2 yet, though, but it's wonderful. It's Monty
Python. It's a nice document. But so, you know, so one of the things we diverge, of course, so when we met... I've softened on the stance, but of course, the namesake of this podcast, It's Been Recorded, was my response to, of course. When we met, the absolute devil of my musical universe was Kiss.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Kiss.
Let's talk about Kiss, man. You get this, you throw that pitch, I'm ready.
Okay.
Is it a hanging curveball? Is it a screwball?
It's a screwball. Well, okay.
Outside corner.
So in terms of me, again, for context, I think I was at the time, and I think I still am in terms of what I listen for in music. I think, back to Morrissey and the Smiths, which is an anti-Kiss.
Oh, you think?
Yes. Okay. No, there is a theatricality too.
If you say so.
To the Moz. There's that great song Panic. And I remember when I heard Panic by the Smiths. And that, you know, lovely, which I have that phrase on the door of my office at Duquesne. Hang the blessed DJ for the music that they constantly play says nothing to me about my life.
Right.
Hang the DJ, hang. And the children's chorus, you know. When I was sort of like musically awoken or started like really caring about music, and I think instead of like passively consuming the radio, sort of actively searching for sounds, that idea of realism or that idea of talking about people's experiences.
Representing you as well.
Representing me as well was for me the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing. And so, yeah, any element of fantasy, any element of...
How old were you?
So, when this happened...
Yes.
For me, 91, 92, 93, like that era, like I fell 15? For the alternative nation hard.
Okay, it's 15-ish?
Yeah, 15, 16, okay. Yeah.
That's always a watershed year in a person's musical taste development, in my opinion. I was at a crossroads myself in high school whenever I was listening to music. Like, I wasn't even passionate about music when I was freshman, sophomore. And wow. Then for me, it was Metallica that came along. But again, that for a future discussion, possibly a little farther down the road, because I don't want to take us too far off the track here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's where I was too. I was at a crossroads, and that spoke to me. So that's kind of similar. I mean, like,
kind of similar. Well, and I think too, well, if we put these again, maybe the Venn diagram together,
mm-hmm.
is of course Metallica as being one of the bands. I think for most people who are Metallica fans, everybody is now a Metallica fan with an asterisk, right?
Oh yeah.
They had it and then it went. And this idea, which again was, I think for me, is a real post-punk idea of being genuine and then potentially losing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in the great words of a friend of mine, they had to eat.
Sounds like a wanker.
Oh, it's
only a wanker would say that.
Quite possibly.
Yeah.
Anywho, but yeah, I mean, like, I think what you were getting at there is, like, whenever you were looking for something personal, something that spoke to you, the DJs really didn't represent you, and mm-hmm. and what was up that alley was maybe some of the stuff that inspired me earlier. Mm-hmm. So I think there's an idea of, you know, where the age occurred with this. Like, whenever Kiss, like, exploded for me, I was 4.
Wow.
So, I mean, there's... You got to allow for 11 years of development there, you know?
Yeah.
And when you're 4 years old and it's 1976 and your heroes are kind of like Mego dolls, like Joker, the Penguin, Batman, and Spider-Man, and comic books, and things that explode off the page, and big ideas and exciting things. When you're 4, Kiss is one of those concepts or those bands that really, really hits the grand slam for the 4-year-old, or even like, you know, the 10-year-old, the 6-year-old, the 7-year-old, because there's that element of, at least in that period for me, was that colorful, exploding fantasy of superheroes and imagination and something a lot bigger than what I had seen in my everyday life. And Kiss for me really delivered on that. And I got to say, I mean, the music was great for me too. You know, I remember when I was little, I didn't dislike one of their songs from any of the 8-tracks that I owned. You know, I mean, there wasn't one where I could be like, well, maybe because you couldn't fast forward on an 8-track. But, well, you could change channels, but then you may bypass Plastercaster or Almost Human.
Yeah.
So that's not an option. But anyway, that's kind of what appealed to me with them is of course, you know, the bigness, the idea, the coalescence of the superhero and the makeup. Mm. And again, I got to refer to the Joker again, because the Joker having that white face and that huge, like, grin and the green and just so loud and, you know, exciting and sugar. A lot of sugar.
A lot of sugar.
You know what I mean? Like, kids like sugar, man.
Yeah,
I mean, like,
sugary breakfast cereals. And...
It's more addictive than heroin to a spider, I'm told. So, I mean, that even proves it more. So, I mean, I think that's not quite a huge leap there. I mean, like, the Joker having that doll and then seeing these guys spitting fire and singing about rock and roll and just exploding stuff. I mean, come on. What's there not to like when you're 4?
When you're 4, yeah. It's, and you have also, I think, another huge difference between us. And it's an age difference thing, and I think it is also, if I'm honest, probably a difference in terms of the relationship maybe that I have with my mom and my parents. You have pleasant memories of the 70s.
Nothing but, as far as, well, you know, that's subjective. There's probably things you don't want to remember, but the good memories of the 70s are... What's the word for it? I don't even know if there is a word for it. Galactic. I mean, it just spans dimensions and times and lifetimes and gods and goddesses and vistas of everything that it would just survive with me past the most amazing gulfs of infinity. You know, not to be too exaggerating there, too much hyperbole, but that's how much it means to me. My first memory is a musical memory. Mm-hmm. My mom was taking me to daycare because I was raised by my mother, and Solitaire by the Carpenters was on the radio, and we may have you know talked about this in a prior podcast, you know, the one that we did before in the rain. But it was Solitaire by the Carpenters, and it really resounded within me because I felt lonely. I was going to daycare. I didn't want to go to daycare. I wanted to stay home. I wanted to be with my mom, but my mom had to work. And so she would take me to downtown Johnstown, to Locust Street, to the church daycare. And I just remember it was like an overcast day early in the morning, that early in the morning vibe where it's overcast and it's November in Pennsylvania. Mm. And it can be depressing, but it can also be uplifting in an artistic way and in kind of a sad, poignant way. And that song really spoke to me because it was where I was at that point in time. And when you can tap into that, when music can tap into that for you, that becomes the things that stick with you. And that's the first memory. I think I was 3 years old, something like that. So, yeah, I mean, when it comes to 70s, The Carpenters' Kiss, Elton John is another huge one. That's a scary moment for me, was listening to Funeral for a Friend by myself in a living room lit only by candles and lava lamps.
Oh, wow. Lava lamps.
Yeah.
That's 70s.
Incense cones. And no, the experience with that was, again, we're along the 70s tip here. My dad and his girlfriend, they went into the kitchen to like maybe get the pizza out of the oven or to get me a 7-Up or something. And they dropped the needle on Funeral for a Friend. And if you're familiar with that intro, it's pretty creepy.
Yeah.
And, you know, in that atmosphere, excuse me, man, the cost is coming up there on me. That experience was, it was really earth-shaking because it was, again, the creepiness of that being alone in the room and just it experiencing something with that sound of the needle on the record and the atmosphere, the darkness, a 70s living room. There's something about a 70s living room that's really perfect for that.
So is the carpet olive green or brown? That's the question.
It was probably any combination of that earth tone. Like yellow was in there somewhere.
Yellow.
Green had to have been in there
wood
somewhere.
Wood panel walls?
Some kind of puke. Yeah. So, yeah, shag probably.
Shag.
But all those memories, even the fearful ones, even the poignant ones, even the jubilant ones, those are those indigenous 70s memories for me from those personalities, from where I was at the time. There's a real correlation and a symmetry to all those artists, even though they may all be polar opposites in a way, like what we're talking about, the Venn diagram.
Yeah.
The Venn diagram of this.
Yeah.
The 70s. So.
Yeah. See, I grew up with this sort of objectified 70s, you know, and I think for me, I don't know, my mom owned 4 copies of the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. Seriously, like she would keep buying that record at yard sales and also had it on 8-track.
Did she even wear them out or they were just preventative maintenance copies?
I think preventative maintenance, or she would just see it. And this is, again, back when vinyl was a quarter.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. I mean, she had the John Travolta insert poster on the wall in the house. And this is in the 90s, you know.
Oh.
And so for me, it was those, like, you have to get away from that. You need your own territory and your own space and fuck the 70s. And, you know, the 70s must be destroyed or whatever.
Understood.
You know, which also then for me, though, is like my 70s is punk.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is that revolution? Is that, granted, you know, dated UK situationalist punk?
Some artists like Ramones.
Ramones, Sex Pistols, The Damned. The Clash, though, I think I'd probably shock most people not being into The Clash as most punk people are. But The Clash is good. The Clash is great.
Yeah.
Clash is fine. But, you know. Yeah, so that's for me. It was that sort of, you know, and then kind of getting into more obscure stuff and like 70s proto-punk, like The Stooges and the MC5 and stuff like that.
It's a 180.
Yeah.
From what you're experiencing.
Yeah.
For sure. I don't know. I don't know if my mom, like, when it comes to, like, your mom had an obsession for those things, and again, the natural...
Disco, yeah.
Yeah, and the natural reaction is to rebel.
Yeah.
Early on, initially...
And you think... Yeah, too.
Yeah, good.
I'm sorry, in pop culture, you know, the 70s were the worst thing ever. Too, you know, if you remember that. I remember reading, like, Bloom County and David Letterman making fun of the 70s, you know? It was like that... you know, that kid in, on the school bus that always puked, you know, you just knew. You didn't have to know that kid, but you just knew that
kid. Well, I didn't mention it, but there was a kid at daycare that puked. It was a little black kid. Every time. Every time I'd go in, and that was kind of, you know, jarring for me. You know what I mean? Like, pukers. I want my mom. Pukers, exactly. What did I say? Some kind of puke. Yeah, he was some kind of puke. And you know, his reaction was a little more violent than mine to where he was. So, but no, I mean, like, I can see where you're coming from, but being someone who kind of, like, hatched from all that, I can't help but feel great about all of it. I mean, like, and again, it's perspective. I mean, yeah. there's could be something said for 80s pop culture is the worst ever.
Yeah, 80s pop culture was pretty bad. I mean, you know, and again, for me, I mean, I was one of those people that, yeah, I mean, I remember what, I know I've told this story before in the podcast. Sorry, Ren, another regular listener.
Oh, I don't care about
the first moment I heard Nirvana on the radio. I remember that moment as like a watershed moment for me because, yeah, I was listening to crappy New York City pop radio. So it was Paula Abdul and El DeBarge and The System. Remember Don't Disturb This Groove?
I tried to forget.
Yeah, I mean, all of that, that was it. And you got stupid. Like, the only rock that came through, like, contemporary rock was... it was fucking U2.
Yeah.
Can we talk about how awful U2 is?
I would love
to. That's a great sidebar. Let's forget about this. How much U2 sucks?
U2, I have said this to you. I thought that their first two albums, Boy and October, were excellent. I think even like The Unforgettable Fire, my mom had it on vinyl. But when Bono decided he was Jesus Christ and was going to save us all, that's whenever they jumped the shark for me. So you personally, you have that same, or
you see, I wouldn't even, I think even retroactively, like, for me, I can't, you know, I will say there was a time before I knew anything about myself that I thought Joshua Tree was like, oh, that's a record, you know, especially those B-sides, you know, because I was already sick of, you know, all those songs that were on the radio all the time. But yeah, fuck that band. Fuck that band and everything that band represents.
I think the first time I started really disliking them was whenever I saw I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. It just seemed so damn gratuitously, you know, just, what a fluff piece. You know what I mean? And like, just trying so hard to be everybody's band, you know, and yuck. And Edge had that tail, too. So, yeah, I'm not happy about them there.
Yeah. You know, Verso has this series called Counter Blasts, where basically, like, they take on, like, the great sacred cows of the left and say, no, they're not left, they're bullshit, and you need to... And there's one about Bono called The Frontman.
Right.
Which I have, and I'm savoring it. I'm, like, two chapters in, and then I get distracted. I want to write one for them about Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, he's probably number one for you, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean... Yeah.
Dartboard material,
yeah.
Yeah. He's another kind of puke.
Yes.
He's not even some kind. He's another kind of puke.
Yeah, I think having grown up in New Jersey and seeing what that culture really means, yeah, fuck Bruce Springsteen. I mean, just, oh.
Oh, he's no ABBA at all. I mean, like, you know, I mean, I think what it is taking oneself too seriously. I think is what it comes down to. And there are levels of that. But the ones that are particularly annoying are the ones where you're under this guise of you're changing everything or you're so important and whatnot. But you're ultimately just another pop thing.
Yeah.
Pop fodder, that kind of thing. And you're still working for the man, even though you think you're not working for the man, because the man wants you to be that segment to the populace. And I think that that's kind of what we're hitting upon here.
Yeah. The most egregious Bruce Springsteen fanboy story I've ever heard was, you know, The Rising, his post 9/11. Supposedly, Bruce, this is a story. And even if this is real and this fucking happened to you and you were a sane human being, you would not tell another human being. But supposedly he went, Bruce Springsteen was at some place in Jersey that overlooked the Hudson, and he was looking at where the towers used to be, and he was walking away, and somebody shouted out of a car window, "We need you, Bruce!" And, like, the fanboy who told me this was like, "Yeah, you know, that's what's so great about that record, you know? It's like, Bruce, you know?" And so it was like, suddenly fucking 9/11 was about him.
Right.
What an asshole! What a radical asshole! Like, that is beyond anything in this universe.
Yeah, it's bad enough that
assholeism.
It's bad enough that that dude would share that. I mean, it's bad enough that that dude would say that. It is much worse that Bruce would share that, because it's not coming off being sincere. It's coming off being what
9/11's about me.
I'm going to save everybody. Me and Rudy.
Yeah.
And yeah. So I mean, yeah, that definitely encapsulates your frustration with him and relates it a lot better to me.
Yeah.
Because, again, you know, what's he going to do? What did he do? What could he do?
And he released an album that people who don't like music like. You know what I mean? Like, it's part of my Bud Miller Lite, I think, Miller Lite theory of the universe. That, you know, Miller Lite is the beer for people who don't like beer. I think there's music for people who don't like music.
If Miller Lite was a beer, you could say that. If his music was music, you could say that.
Yeah.
I don't think they are. The only thing I like by Bruce is Born in the USA stuff. Like, I liked it at the time, like Dancing in the Dark, but man, it's a terrible song now to me. And the video's even worse. Like, Courtney Cox is in it. And all that kind of thing. So, yeah, there's our rant on the heroes of, in their own mind, guys.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, I remember even, you know, and I liked the band at the time, but VH1, back when VH1 Classic was still a thing, before it became MTV Classic, they had an R.E.M. weekend.
Right.
And I totally forgot about the savior complex of their celebrity in the 90s.
Okay.
And I was like, and at the time, I mean, I have a lot of R.E.M. CDs and records. And it was like, for me, almost like, if I would enjoy any of them now. And I have a hard time, actually, honestly, this is another musical difference between us. For me, it's sometimes hard to hear things I heard more than 5 years ago.
Okay.
I have a hard time going back. Yeah. Like, that scale of what's still acceptable in the back catalog for me is tiny, tiny, tiny.
If I may tangentialize just for a second, that side of your beard looks like a Van Gogh painting. It's like Starry Night right now.
Oh, sorry, man.
No, it's awesome.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, so anyway.
Trim. Anyway.
Eddie Vedder's another one.
Eddie Vedder. Oh, God, yeah. Pearl Jam, the only band that anybody could... Oh, God.
I think it all revolves around... when you put that guy on a savior pedestal, I mean, the music's inevitably going to suffer because it becomes less about the music and more about that one person. I mean,
about their celebrity and more about the brand of their celebrity.
Right, right. It's like Levi's or anything else. And 10 is such a good album for me, and I think it's very aesthetically pleasing. And I don't give a rat's behind about the lyrics. I really haven't ever... That's another difference between you and me with that.
That's the way I changed.
Oh.
I went away from lyrics.
Oh, come to us.
Yes.
We're here for you.
Yes.
That's the Nev diagram. That's where we are actually together all the time.
Yeah.
But anyways, the Eddie Vedder thing, 10 is such a great aesthetic album. I mean, the tones are good. They would say it sounds too produced and too reverbed out because they did a drier version of it, they took the studio reverb out. But that represents a summer for me where, you know, kind of rainy nights and yet it was nice and warm out and swimming pools and friends and beer and stuff like that. I didn't wear flannels though, I will say that. I do now, but not then. And that album was Oceans. It's such a beautiful song.
Yeah.
It's great. I mean, it embodies the title, it embodies, you know, what they're going for with the vibe there, and it really spoke to me. And then it just became this lead singer thing and it didn't become a song thing. You know, and then you can tell when it's not a song. It's not writing for the song. You have five guys involved. It's got to be five guys or the song they're creating. And it just became, we hate Ticketmaster, and we're going to change things, and this is our guy. And it's just, it's lead singeritis. It's the glorification of the vocal, whereas the vocal is the most limited instrument there is. Yeah. You can't play fast on a vocal usually. Your range is limited. Now, I don't not hate vocals. I love instrumental music, though, but there's an over-glorification of music. An over-glorification of vocals in music. It's only one part of music.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to make it all parts of music. And that's the problem with a lot of these guys that we're talking about. It has to be the vocal, the vocal, the vocal, the vocal. I'm sorry, Mozart didn't need it. Beethoven didn't need it. Bach didn't need it. Any of the early greats or any of your favorite classical composers, they didn't need vocals. We don't need it now. I'm done. I'm out of here, man. Just get this microphone off. Pretend like I'm taking a microphone off. Okay.
All right, we're back. John, just calm down.
I took my song.
Yeah, but that's for me, like, now, the celebrity of R.E.M., like, is an obstacle to listening to that music.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, there's some of those songs. Like, Up is still a really good album.
Lost your religion.
God. That's the other thing. Is too, for me, in terms of things that turn me off musically, is pop radio success. Mm-hmm. God, if I can go the rest of my life never hearing Losing My Religion ever again. And, you know, Pearl Jam 10, I wore that tape out. A friend illegally dubbed that cassette for me.
Oh, boy.
And I wore it out. I literally wore that cassette out. Granted, I only maybe had 5 or 6 cool cassettes at the time, but I wore that fucker out.
Oh, it's a great album.
I don't know if I could hear it again.
If you, it's already part of your DNA. Why would you?
Yeah.
But no, it's part of that Seattle scene. But it is like, as much as they were all lumped into the same category, I think they all are very radically different sounding. I don't think Nirvana sounds like Pearl Jam. I don't think Pearl Jam sounds like Soundgarden. I don't think Soundgarden sounds like Alice in Chains. That was the beauty of a movement like that, is they didn't sound the same. And Pearl Jam was part of that with that album, for sure. There's a lot of aesthetic beautiness in that. Beauty in that. See, I'm still not recovered from that I just took my mic off. But I'm back. All right.
All right, we're good.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, pleasant memories, I don't know, man.
Well, what are your pleasant memories? What's your greatest era of nostalgia? I mean, like, what is the era?
You know what? It's probably here in Loretto.
The late 90s?
The 90s. But here's the thing. So I got here and music died. Because that's the other thing about what happened in the 90s is, I think, what is referred to... Stereogum had some nice articles a couple years ago about it. What was referred to as the major label signing frenzy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, the great story about Nevermind being, you know, it's the first and probably only... It's the only album ever to get to number one on returns. When that record hit number one, it was, and this totally freaked everybody in the industry out, it wasn't that people were buying that CD, is that kids got Michael Jackson Dangerous for Christmas and were returning it to the record stores unopened and exchanging it for Nevermind.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I understand the definition of returns now.
Yeah.
And I thought I did when you first said so. That's why I did not inquire. But that's when you take an album back and the album you get in return is, and that was number one.
That made that record number one.
I didn't know that was a category.
Yeah. Well, no, it was the number one record. Number one overall. But it wasn't that people were buying that week, at least the first week that it turned number one. Was on returns.
Okay.
On strictly the strength of people getting that CD, ditching Michael Jackson's Dangerous primarily.
The people have spoken there, literally.
Yeah. I
mean, wow, that's a statement.
And so the thing that, you know, happened was then the record industry, back when the record industry had money, signed anyone and anything that was, quote, alternative, was from Seattle, was played in the same venues that Nirvana played, and there was just this huge diversity in the music that was sort of being sold to people.
Mm-hmm.
By the late 90s, you had the fucking Nixons and 7 Mary 3 and all those Pearl Jam light bands that were just horrid. But for me, it is the 90s, I guess, because it was mine.
Well, and also because, I mean, like, in the midst of that, you still were discovering some things that didn't need to be new. I mean, like, you still were reaching,
It's been recorded.
Right. exactly.
It'll always be there. Hey. Maybe I'll come around to kiss before I die. It'll always be there. It's been recorded.
I advise Hotter Than Hell. We listened to that one time. That album is... That, and also, too, probably because we're here in Loretto, and my story with Hotter Than Hell is my uncle brought my cousin and I to Loretto one day, and this was probably in 1978 or 77, and they just came out with this with the Kiss cards, the trading cards, the first edition, and he bought, and there were two boxes. He bought a box for me, and he bought a box for my cousin, who wasn't as much into Kiss at the time as me, but he couldn't just, like, buy me a box of cards and buy and get him a push-up.
Yeah.
Or, like, a pixie stick. So or Razzles. So he bought us these the box of Kiss cards, and his 8-track player I brought Hotter Than Hell, and it was perfect for the day for whatever reason. And we went over to the Schwab Gardens and we fed the goldfish, and Hotter Than Hell is now like permanently emblazoned on my brain when it comes to Loretto sunny weather, because, you know, that was that memory. It's their second album. The production is awful. It's over-compressed. It's over... They tried to sound like Sabbath in the production. And it just... It ended up being really clicky, and meaning like an in-tone. Like it's really, really harsh to the ear. But it's also very unique. And the songs are super, super solid. I mean, it's really good. So that's my advice to you, is Hotter Than Hell. To give that one more of a shot.
Okay.
So anyways.
We'll see. It's been recorded. I'll get to it. I got some years left.
You got a Van Gogh beard, so we're good.
I got a Van Gogh beard. Yeah. My A1C looks good, according to the doctor. So there
Sweet.
We go.
Congratulations. Yeah,
thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So I guess in terms of my musical universe, or this collision, is there anything that you like that you would be shocked, that I might be shocked to find out you like?
No.
No?
Because I think you know me well enough.
I know you well enough.
Boy, I don't know.
Or is there something you came around on since we first met? Is there anything that was the devil, and then you go, oh, you know what, that's actually really good?
Oh, man. I don't know. I'd really have to plumb that depth a little bit more. It might come. Let me stew on that a little bit as we go.
Okay.
Doesn't nothing on the surface yet, because like I said, you know how weird my tastes are.
Yeah.
I can go from ABBA to Mr. Bungle to, you know, whatever, like any spectrum, any area of the spectrum and a genre means nothing to me. I love anything that inspires me. So let me stew on that.
Let's stew on that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, because one of the ways I changed, I went from being a lyrics man to not caring. Actually, so most of this day drive that I made from Pittsburgh, I've been listening to this song by Mogwai called Music for a Forgotten Future, which was, it's a 20-something minute piece that they composed for a fountain that some artist created. And it was supposed to accompany the cycle of the water in the fountain. No words, of course. No words. That band has one song that they genuinely sing on that was on a Pixies tribute album.
Mm-hmm.
What's your opinion on the Pixies?
I've never really delved much.
Oh, you see? Doolittle. Doolittle.
Okay.
Terrible production, but I'll say, so that's one of the few I can go back to. There was a time when I was living in this great town of Loretto, every party I had at my house on St. Peter Street that no longer exists.
St. Peter Street no longer exists?
Well, the house no longer exists. To St. Peter Street, or 144 St. Peter Street, depends.
Yeah.
On what the house number was. I came home one day and the house number was different. Did I ever tell you that?
No.
Yeah, my house, it said 2. It was 2 St. Peter Street. And then I came home one day and it said 144 St. Peter Street. And I was like,
as a sign.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
What's next?
But there was a time in that house where every party, eventually Doolittle would come on.
Mm-hmm.
And that record being so full of manic energy,
mm-hmm,
and pop hooks and just the craziness. You know, growing up for me, I guess it was too, you know, everything was nice but fake. And for something like that, that was just so abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, at times, you know, the vocal is just screamed, you know. Or there's, you know, at one point, you know, it's just Frank Black breathing. like, that's what you get. Right. And it's like, to have that on a record is just, yeah, you know.
Open
was
your eyes,
so man. So decadent and so, you know, counter everything.
Self-indulgent.
Self-indulgent. And now I live in that world. But there was a time in my life, every single party at my house, eventually Doolittle would come on. Usually late in the evening, later in the evening, not at the end, but sort of latter day, when everybody was as drunk as they were going to get and things were about to get ugly.
Is that an early release of theirs?
Yes, so that was 89. Okay. And so it was Come On Pilgrim was 87, 88. So I think Doolittle, was it Doolittle or Surfer Rosa?
For some reason, I think of Sonic Youth when I think of the Pixies, and they probably don't sound anything remotely like each other. But aren't they the same from the same era?
Same era, yeah. They sort of shared that same historical moment. Of course, Sonic Youth had that huge, I mean, from, what, 82, 83 till, what, 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's a band. I just recently went through a Sonic Youth phase, you know, pulling out Washing Machine and Daydream Nation. I mean, you talk about a band that evolved and was, you know, iconoclastic and kept growing as a band. I mean, those records, speaking of 9/11 and rock, those records that they put out in the aughts, Murray Street and New York City Ghosts and Flowers, holy shit.
That's a great title, that last one. I like that. Oh, I thought of a couple, by the way.
Okay.
Zebra Head.
Oh, my God. I have their Christmas single.
They have a Christmas single?
They put out a Christmas single, yeah. The ultra bro-y Christmas single, you know.
Hat round backwards.
Yes.
That's the ultra bro-y look.
Yes.
Yeah. So Zebrahead's one.
Zebrahead, I have that CD. Oh, God. They had that one song, but man, what a horrid aesthetic.
Well, it's on the heels of the Limp Bizkit thing, and they do have some good songs off Waste of Mind. Like, Someday's a good one. My buddy Darren Denny actually gave me that CD because he had an extra or something like that, because I don't know, from a radio station or something, and he gave me that, and it's I listened to it on my walk the day I left your place the other day, by the way.
Really?
It's this kind of day. It's like a sunny day type of vibe, and then I put on some 24/7 Spies, and Jimmy Hazel wished me a happy birthday on Facebook from the Spies, so that was one of the best days of my life the following day.
Yeah. There you go. Which, that's a band I got from you.
Yeah.
I learned it by watching you, man. 24/7 Spies.
Gumbo, man. You ain't parting with that vinyl, are you?
No. Well, you know what, though? Actually, you think that's the reason why that record's through, but that sleeve is totally messed up.
I know.
I don't know if you looked at that sleeve.
Yeah, it is. The record's good.
The record's good.
It sounded clean.
I'm amazed that they didn't have a copy of that at Jerry's.
I will uncover one. I mean, I wanted to get it. I mean, they're available on eBay. I actually even messaged Mr. Hazel about it at some point, but he never got back to me, probably because he's flooded with, like, 17,000, man, not that many, but I mean, they were pretty popular at one point with the underground, and you know, I just want to find one someday.
Organically, that was for me. Husker Du Warehouse Songs and Stories.
Mm-hmm.
I looked for that record for about 10 years,
got it. You didn't want to eBay it.
I didn't want to eBay it.
Oh.
I just wanted to go through a rack the one day, and it would just be there.
Like the Christmas present waiting to happen.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what
took
Gumbo
me 10 went. Years. And then I didn't know what to do. And then Sunny Day Real Estate, How It Feels to Be Something On, which was the soundtrack of my undergraduate depression here in Loretto.
Oh, boy.
If you want gloomy Loretto day, Sunny Day Real Estate is a beautiful autumnal record where the lyrics, there are lyrics, but it's almost like opera. Like, it doesn't really matter what he's saying, but the emotion by which Jeremy sings it is enough. And thanks to Sub Pop, reissued that, so not soon after I was able to just get that. You could buy that at most record stores now, because Sub Pop, nothing ever goes out of print forever.
I want to build my gloomy Loretto Day collection, so I may have to peruse that a little bit.
You need to get that record. You need that record in your life.
Just to relate, like, my gloomy Loretto experience days are probably like Iron Maiden, Somewhere in Time. That album has a real
Wasted Years.
It has a foggy production to it. It's very misty sounding. Sea of Madness is one of them too. That's yeah.
Is that the one Maiden album I own? I think that's the one Maiden CD I own.
My favorite, and it's never any Maiden fan's favorite. Every Maiden fan's favorite is usually the one with the Trooper on it, Peace of Mind, and then also Number of the Beast. Some people claim Power Slave as well, but. Somewhere in Time is just so wonderful. So that's one. And The Rush Chronicles, Disc 2, their 80s period, with Subdivisions and Big Money and Red Sector A and Distant Early Warning, Mystic Rhythms. All those 80s Rush songs are really good. Loretto, Rainy Day, Misty Overcast thing. But the other thing, too, is like songs like that are really good for like in the middle of Ebensburg, walking through the sidewalks on an overcast rainy day. Probably even more so in Montreal, which I hope to get to soon.
Yeah.
You know, so, but yeah, that's my rainy Loretto thing.
Yeah.
You're ruminating. I see.
I'm ruminating, you know. The late 90s. So that's the thing. So I have this weird like nostalgic. It's like, I like listening to early 90s music in the late 90s.
Right.
That's my nostalgia.
Just you that know, window.
And like weird 80s pop.
Mm-hmm.
Mexican Radio by Wall of Voodoo.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like stuff like that was just too weird to be famous, but there it was.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Cars by Gary Numan.
Oh, yeah. That's great. That's so good.
Yeah.
I always liked Wild Boys by Duran Duran.
Yeah.
It's not one of their hits. Run Runaway by Slade. That's a really cool song. The 80s had a lot of diversity too. I mean, like, yeah, even though they kind of fell under that umbrella, there was so much personality and individuality within each band that they all stood out pretty well.
Again, though, when I got awoken, and then it was like, you know, you go through the musical genealogy, you go Nirvana, Pixies, Husker Du, you know, and then like Black Flag, and like getting turned on to the 80s underground was also, and I think for me, I experienced the early 90s and the 80s underground simultaneously. And you talk about like a musical overdose.
Yeah.
You know, of just quality stuff. My first time hearing like XTC.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know.
Yeah. The rebirth, you know.
Yeah.
So for you, my question is, did you more or less gravitate to a group of bands? Like for me, I was always very OCD about singular bands in my development. Like it went from Elton John to Kiss to Prince to Metallica to Rush to Led Zeppelin, Faith No More, and it was kind of dissipated as I went, as far as like central to one artist. You know what I mean? Did you ever do one artist, or was it more like
I still have my obsessions, yeah,
but I mean along where, the way, did you have kind of like that ladder to where you're going, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I could say like my favorite band, you know, or that kind of thing, or the band that represented me has changed over the years.
Yeah.
And so for me, I think the it was probably Bad Religion, Dead Kennedy Sidebar, Husker Du, Bob Mould Sugar, that sort of thing for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'll never forget, you know, like Neutral Milk Hotel. Hearing that for the first time, we were playing Over the Sea.
My brother loves that. He loves that band. What's his name?
Jeff Magnum.
He actually talked to him on the phone.
No way!
Yeah, they called him. My brother and like some of his friends, they actually talked to him, and he was really cool.
Wow.
You may need to podcast that, Kat.
Yeah, I should. Damn.
I've never called. Wait. Yeah, I have. Well, my buddy did. Mike Keneally. He played in Steve Vai's band and also Frank Zappa's, I think. Mm. And he has his own huge solo. It wasn't huge, but like he definitely has a following. My buddy Wade called him. We were in Bloomsburg and asked him. This was the debate of the night. He said, "Do you think it's more important to have talent or to practice, like to have desire or natural talent?" And Keneally's just like, "Oh, I think natural talent probably supersedes a bit." And I was just like, I was really disappointed, because I always thought, from my own personal experience, I have some natural talent. I mean, but I worked pretty hard at, like, you know, I'm a late bloomer, man. You know, I'm a guitar player, and I did not get things going on like until probably when I started learning theory and that kind of thing. So I kind of like looked upon him as maybe justifying that a bit, but I was like, oh, come on, man, like the Mike Keneally, you know what I mean? So that's the only time I've really talked to anyone famous over the phone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Anyone famous over the phone with you?
Over the phone? No. Swapped emails with Henry Rollins once.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I sort of met people over merch tables and stuff. Yeah. And I got to meet John Waters once. Found footage festival guys.
Shitty David Bowie.
Yeah. There's that, but... No. Nobody over the phone. Mm-hmm. Very anti-phone, I think, these days.
Yeah, there's the.
I have to figure out actually how to do the podcast through the phone.
Here.
I want to start doing long distance stuff. There's a poet in Seattle I'm supposed to do a podcast with, but I have to figure out, you know, logistics. Yeah, and I bought from Radio Shack, back when Radio Shack was a thing, actually a device for recording phone calls. And the manager was like, you know this is illegal, right?
Why is he selling it?
Exactly. And I was like, no, I know. It's for a podcast. It would be consensual. Okay, well, I have to make sure you have to know before I sell it to you.
Did you have to show him your driver's license?
No.
I mean, what
the... No, I just got a lecture. I just got a lecture that I shouldn't be buying this thing that I bought.
That is so typical America. Anyway.
Anyway. But yeah, so there's that Bad Religion. I remember, like, first hearing Bad Religion. Like, you're angry liberals. Angry liberal punk. You know, and that... Still like me some bad. I wrote this last conference paper I presented. I pulled out all my Bad Religion CDs and was like, okay, I can do this once.
Mm-hmm.
Once a year.
Yeah.
Bad Religion Day.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just said that. I would fixate on artists, and I still kind of do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where I'll, if I hear something, I will then immediately, like, plunge the back catalog or go to used places
and
just buy, you know, buy it all in like a month.
Absolutely. I did the same. Well, Blue Murder may be another one that surprises you that I like, but I, you know, I like my share of hair bands.
Yeah.
But I got into
hair metal. That's evil.
Yeah, but they could play.
Yeah.
They could play. Oh. And a lot of them could write, you know, so that's the saving grace for me. I mean, like, yeah, now we're really going to freaking Nev diagram it. Venn diagram it. Or you need no diagram it. It was the hair metal thing. Because, like, Winger, I love. And I know you absolutely despise their ilk. But there's something about their sound. I love. They have an unbelievable freaking roster of musicians. Like Rod Morgenstein from Dixie Dregs. And then, you know, Reb Beach, who is actually from Fox Chapel.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's Western Pennsylvania guy.
You know, but they could write.
And
they could play the hell out of their instruments. And they had really, really good hooks, good choruses. So I will stand up for them every day.
Yeah, what a deal with the devil they made. I don't know. I was never invited to those parties. And the other thing that that invokes is the Velsen Vajokovic principle.
Which is?
The Velsen Vajokovic. So he was the Bulgarian master. He is, or was, the Michael Jordan of the European handball circuit.
Whoa.
You could go on YouTube and watch clips of him doing stuff in the mid-80s. You know, the handball thing where it's not like racquetball, but literally like you have this like volleyball-sized ball on a court with a net. Mm-hmm. It's like soccer meets like water polo or something.
Ping-pong-ish
thing, and you know it's a team sport, and you run down the court and you throw the ball at the thing, and you have to dribble, and yeah, he's the greatest ever. He's the Bulgarian master. Do you care?
Mm-hmm. Do I care?
Yeah, Velsen Vajokovic.
I greatest anything. I would care.
Okay, you're more enlightened. To me, it's like okay, that's great. Don't care.
Well,
it exists.
I'm being a little flippant. I mean, I'm not gonna say. Definitely, though. I mean, it's something I might be intrigued by if I saw a video of.
YouTube's out there, man.
It is.
But that's my principle for if something might be great, but there's so many things in the world that you can't pay attention to every great thing.
That's good
so point. I invoke the Velsen Vajokovic principle.
And that extends to TV shows.
Yes. Yeah.
Because you will
pretty
not.
Pretty much all TV is Velsen
you
Vajokovic.
You will not watch a show. I tried so hard.
Twin Peaks, and I'll watch Handmaid's Tale. And I'm out.
Well. Half of that equation is certainly up my alley.
Yeah.
Twin Peaks, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, we're season 2, episode 18, I think. So
well, they jumped the shark long before that in that season.
Well, yeah, and I got to get to the end and Firewalk with Me for Sunday.
Have you never seen them through to the end, though? Like, you've never... This is not a repeat showing. This is where you're at
Yeah, I
right
sometimes
now.
Gave up.
Okay.
On Twin Peaks. I gave up at some point on Twin Peaks.
That's season 2, yeah. I mean, like, season 1 is perfection, but season 2 is weird. David Lynch's big middle finger to ABC and its sponsors.
Yeah.
You know, so. But that's okay.
Yeah.
I think the new one's going to be spectacular.
I hope so.
Yeah. I don't even know what that word means.
Yes.
But anyways.
Anyways. Want to get on to the bottom five?
I will do my best.
All right, bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic, but are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature.
I blew it last time. I'm going to try real hard this time.
Try real hard. Oh, do you remember what questions I asked you last time? I should have looked those up.
The pet peeve was the one that just stumped me. I could not think of one.
I was going to ask this one this time, but...
Oh, no.
I didn't.
Don't do it again.
Don't do it again.
I'm feeling like Bill Buckner.
Bill Buckner.
Oy.
All right, question one. What's the strangest injury you've ever suffered? Not worst injury, but the weirdest way you've ever gotten hurt.
I was on the hood of a car one time.
That's the start. There we go.
Okay, so there was this thing where in 1994, where it was probably July, something like that, and for whatever reason, like our crew of Carrolltown cronies, me and this one particular dude, we decided it would be a good idea at the top of Old Dutch Road, the one hill, to get on the hood of the car where the windshield is, but not on the driver's side. We weren't that crazy. But two of us, we were laying down. Like, picture your head being at the top of the windshield and the remainder of your torso on the bottom of the windshield and your legs on the hood.
On the hood, yeah.
So we're both laying there, and the driver just tears down the hill 60 miles an hour. And we're on this hood in this woods road at 3 o'clock in the morning, all of us drunk out of our minds. And my buddy he's getting up during this. Like, can you believe this, man? And I'm just like, get back. You know what I mean? Like, why would you even move? Why are you doing this? So, okay, it turned out all right. The next day, we do the same thing again, except it's in the daytime, all right? And we get on the hood of his brother's car. I got on the hood of his brother's car.
What kind of car was it, by the way?
An Escort.
Oh, okay.
He called it the Nugget because it was like gold and it was more like a butt nugget. And so I'm on the hood, and this time only 10 miles an hour. Same deal. He slams on the brakes. I fly off, break my elbow.
Oh.
Impact fracture. And so I had a gig the next week at a church festival, and there's pictures of me with my arm in a sling and a mustache. That's the strangest injury I've ever had.
Well, but you still were able to play.
Barely.
Barely. All right. Question two. Okay, this maybe is a little too close to our main topic, but I'll do it. This is more of a prompt. Tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood. Happy but unremarkable memory. So no, not going to Disney World, but rainy day baked cookies memory.
Oh my. Wow. There's so many of them. Like just little innocent sidebar things.
Yeah, just pick one.
Oh, this is a great one. Okay, so my aunt lived in Ebensburg on the main drag right across the road from the graveyard there. This is like 1982-ish. And prior to that period, my mom and I lived in this section of Richland and Johnstown on Allwine Street in this apartment building. And up until 1981, I think I never had any kind of real lasting memory scars. Like, of course, you experience the bad times and whatnot, and being raised by a single mother is not easy all the time. And but then we moved, and it crushed me. It was one of the worst things that's ever happened to me. And I did not want to move. We had a cat. We had to give it up because there were no pets at the next place we were moving to. And so I was crestfallen beyond belief. It was awful. But the one saving grace for me was my aunt's place in Ebensburg. I would stay with her periodically. And by the way, this convent that's up here over the hill, she was a nun there. She left, you know, the Carmel. I think the Carmel. No, it's Sisters of Mercy, and they're no longer there anymore. But I used to stay up in that convent, and to like an 8-year-old, 7-year-old boy, it was like a castle. I would explore the rooms.
Wow.
I'd go upstairs. There is a huge fireplace. We had The Hobbit on vinyl. I'll try to keep that to a minimum with you. But we would. I would stay there, and it was the greatest. It was so beautiful and wonderful, and she was just so good to me. And so she eventually moved to Ebensburg, and we would have these days where, you know, usually in the summertime, and she wanted me to go outside. You know, that's what you did in the early 80s when you were that kind of kid. Okay?
Yeah.
So there was a game on, and the Giants were playing the Pirates, and I was a Pirate fan then. I grew up a Pirate fan. I became a Giant fan. So the irony is they were playing the Giants. Sure they were playing the Giants. And I wanted to watch the game. You know, it was a Sunday game, and it was like a 4 o'clock start. She's like, you're going outside. And I'm like, I'm watching the game. So she wheeled the TV onto the front porch, overlooking overlooking the highway, like the main drag across from the graveyard. And I watched that game, like, in the sunshine on the front porch, and it was...
That's so good.
She really became the MVP of my youth at that point. I mean, yeah. Like, I mean, talk about taking a dispute and just making it so good for everybody.
Wow.
Baseball, beautiful weather, Ebensburg Graveyard. That's an awesome memory.
That is an awesome memory.
Yeah.
All right, question three. Is there anything in your home that you're afraid of?
The ghosts, I think, may have occasioned me from time to time. There was a time about a year ago, I have these Rush re-release. They were re-released probably a couple years ago on 200-gram vinyl. They're really well done. And each one of them has a sticker in them. And I'm pretty OCD about taking care of my records. You know, I put everything back where it's supposed to be. And, you know, I always put everything back. And the one morning, you know, I woke up and went downstairs. There were two stickers on the floor by my records that were just laying there. And I know that I didn't leave them there.
Wow.
And I asked my students if anybody put them there. And I don't know if someone was messing with me or whatever, but I did not put those stickers there. So
that's weird.
In my house, I am afraid possibly of ghosts. You know, I never used to be. Whenever my mom and my grand passed away and they were in that house a lot, it was my gram's house. So that's something, just because maybe they're not at peace.
Mm.
That's what would scare me. As far as anything structurally with that house, there is a hole in the basement filled with water that has stuff growing out of it. That's scary. But my uncle reassures me it's perfectly fine.
There you go.
So, yeah, kinda.
There you go.
Yeah.
Question four, and this is the Christopher Hitchens question, because he brought this idea up to me. Of the living villains of history, whose obituary would you like to write? Mm. You got an opportunity to write the obituary of a famous living villain of history. Who would it be?
Usually I kind of cancel out those people. I don't need them in my life. I don't even think about them. There's nothing I can do about them.
Mm.
So I kind of just leave it to whomever to talk about them, to do something about them. Mm. I don't know. Get me rolling here. What do you define as a villain? Like, let's explore.
So I'll tell you. So where this came from, the origin story of this question is, it's in Christopher Hitchens' book, Mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the book he wrote as he was dying of cancer. And he's talked about when he was first diagnosed, he said about how much he looked forward to. He's like, I'll be deprived of reading the obituaries of Pope Benedict, Cardinal Ratzinger, and Henry Kissinger.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, wait, I wanted to write those.
Because he really wanted to...
To sell the story of this life, that of this person who made the world a significantly worse place.
I would go with Bud Adams, former owner of the Houston Oilers, simply because, and I know this is at a much lesser level than most...
Henry Kissinger, yeah.
You would think.
You would think, yeah.
And this man not only relocated the Houston Oilers from their hometown, but he also kept the name. So now, when they got their franchise back, they could only use the Houston Texans.
Mm.
If you're aware of the history, the pageantry of the Houston Oilers, the Love You Blue, just the history of how colorful they were and whatnot, the fact that he would, number one, uproot that team,
yeah,
because they wouldn't pay for a new stadium, and he's this mega gazillion billionaire.
Yeah.
These guys are the scum of the earth. They want you to pay for what they are already making gazillions off of, and then they'll move your team, and then they'll keep the name. That's a villain to me. I would write
salt in the earth. Yeah,
I would write his obituary and just skewer him on a pole on a freaking oil fire. That's who I would do.
All right, Maybe Donald Trump. You might have to get in line for that one.
You think?
He's
pretty popular. All right.
Yeah. All right. So question five.
I'm doing pretty well so far.
You're doing well. You're almost out of the woods here.
Don't Judas me.
All right. So if we were living... Okay, so this has a scenario. Imagine we are living in a dystopian future, right? And the only books to survive would be those bound in human skin. That's it. All the other books get destroyed unless it's bound in human skin. Would you, and what book would you donate your skin for? So basically, if you don't, march yourself to the tannery with this book in hand. It is erased from human history.
It's actually called a tannery. Will it take human skin?
Yeah, the human skin tannery.
And make books out of it?
Make books out of it. And you can't say the Bible, the Quran, or the complete works of Shakespeare. Oh. Those are cop-outs. Hmm. People already got those.
Okay.
So is there a book that you would donate your skin for so that it could survive throughout human history?
Anything pertaining to Mr. Rogers.
Okay.
Whether it's his biography, autobiography. I can't think of anything specific, though. I was going to say The Hobbit, but I know you'd kill me.
I'm sure The Hobbit's safe. I'm sure somebody got that.
Oh, okay. Well, you're thinking something specific, though, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm thinking of a title, yeah.
Oh, crap.
Is there a biography of Mr. Rogers?
There's gotta be, man.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it would be. I mean, I met the guy. He was one of the most beautiful souls for the 10 minutes we talked that I've ever met. And one of my idols and one of the greatest human beings that ever lived, in my opinion. I would gladly donate my skin to the preservation
of Mr. Rogers'
legacy. Yes, I would.
There you go.
For sure.
All right. I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and, well, it'll be about something.
I hope.
Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on iTunes, I guess, so that's harder now, or Apple thing now. It takes a week, or I don't know. We're on other subscription services, and I have no idea how they work, so there you go. Follow us on Twitter, at gonnadiepodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Later, meets.